You're listening to Face Off, episode 28, recorded August 1st, 2009. Face Off. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, Mark. It's another hot week, but not quite as bad. But we're continuing to trudge on through the heat.
Yeah.
Let's just get right into the show. So the first bit of news we want to talk about is this recent news that Yahoo will actually be using the Bing search technology. For their search technology for, I don't know, how many years was it?
10.
The deals
we'll
for
get
10
into
years.
The details here in a minute. This shocked me. I was, for some reason, I was not prepared for this. I mean, we've been looking at, in the news, you know, Microsoft was trying to buy Yahoo and different things, and I never thought it was going to go through, and now all of a sudden, they're giving up their search technology in favor of Bing, which is Microsoft's new search technology.
So what did they use before this?
Well, that's the thing, is I was shocked that they would even consider using somebody else's technology, but actually, it turns out I went to digging around in Yahoo, and they've been doing this for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, in 2001, it was, you know, if you remember, it was kind of like a directory system.
Yep.
And then they kind of wanted to do searchable as well as the directory. They wanted to kind of, you know, substitute that in. And Inktomi, I think is how you pronounce it, was the search engine that provided those results.
Okay.
And they're kind of like an OEM. You know, they did AltaVista, Hotbot, you know, some of those search engines.
Back
in the day.
Hotbot was just the best, I remember, for a while. And then I found Metacrawler, which was like, it searched like five different search engines.
Yeah, Dogpile.
Dogpile did the same thing, yep.
So, you know, back then you had a couple companies that were providing the search results, and then you had a front end. You know, Yahoo had this portal, and they were using somebody else's technology, in this case, Inktomi. That kind of surprised me. I thought Yahoo was just kind of doing their own thing from the beginning.
I guess it didn't surprise me. I guess I thought earlier, I remember when, so what year was it they actually announced that they were using Google search technology?
Between 2001 and 2004, it doesn't say the specific date, but
I remember that announcement, and I remember hearing about it, and I was like, oh, that's cool. But I didn't know that they had been using other people's search technology for a long time.
Yeah.
Which is surprising. But again,
I had no idea they were actually using Google.
Yeah.
I just figured Yahoo is just not as good as, indexing results.
I remember for a while there, I mean, if you went to Yahoo and searched, it smelled of Google.
Really?
I mean, you could tell it, yeah.
They pretty much had the same results.
Pretty much, yeah.
And then after 2004, they went independent, and they had their own thing, and it was called Yahoo Search Technology, YST.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're switching over to Microsoft.
Yeah. Which is, it's good, I think. Anyways, it's seen as like a market shift. You know, when Microsoft was talking about buying Yahoo, the same sort of discussions came up. It was like, so instead of, you know, bickering between each other, maybe we should join forces because Google's getting pretty big, and the deal fell through. It was kind of a really big hubbub in Silicon Valley for a while. It was like everybody thought stuff was going to happen, and then the deal fell through, and Yahoo's shareholders were pretty teed off. They fired the CEO, didn't they? Or he resigned or something. I thought there was a big shakeup at Yahoo management. I'm pretty sure after this. I guess I can't verify it, and I should look it up, but if not, if I'm wrong, we'll just do a follow-up next week. But and it was kind of a big deal, but this is kind of a good way for them to join forces without Yahoo getting fully bought out by Microsoft.
It's true.
Bing's gaining market share. I mean, it's grown since it was just live search.
Yeah. I mean, is it still just live search? They just renamed it and added some things?
They apparently put a whole different back end behind it so that it's supposed to get you more relevant results. The joke was for a while there that almost every search result ended up with a Microsoft product, but I haven't seen that lately.
It actually still exists for Linux. If you type in Linux, it says Linux on Vista, Linux on Microsoft. It's kind of shady if you ask me, but
yeah.
But I do agree. It does do, you know, fairly decent job as far as, but you know, I've used Google for so long that it's hard to compare. It's hard to like go to like Yahoo or somewhere like that and just start searching.
Well, one thing we kind of had a difference of opinion on was I like the Bing homepage, like the Bing search. I like that it's a big picture. It's, you know, Google's clever, but I've seen it for so long. It's just a big white page. And it's kind of nice to go and see like a picture of the day with like little fun facts and stuff. But you don't like that.
Yeah, I just prefer, you know, a text box. Yeah, the logo, you know, is pretty much the only image on the page. And I don't really think about it. You know, I use the Firefox toolbar at the top there mainly anyway.
Really?
So I really don't.
I don't at all.
Go to the Google home front, you know, page.
Yeah. Much. It's funny. I mean, I almost get ostracized by my peers because I always open a tab and go to google.com.
Really?
Which is, so I guess I should say that usually I have Google, the customized Google homepage. If I'm logged in. Oh, so usually yeah. It seems almost like it never knows what you want to do, but if you go to google.com and if you're logged in, it'll take you to the google/IG, which is iGoogle, which is not a big white page. You can theme it, you can do what you want with it, and mm-hmm. I have like kind of a nice theme that I'm happy with.
Maybe that's the difference. Maybe you want to go see your little portal page, whereas I don't even have one set up.
Well, the truth is anymore, I don't even use my portal page that much. Yeah. Basically, I just use, there's a bookmark widget on the side. I still have all my old widgets. I haven't removed them, but the bookmark widget and the Google Reader widget are the big ones. The Gmail widget now is worthless, which Google needs to fix, because if you have the Gmail widget in your iGoogle, if you have it selected to only go to use HTTPS, the widget doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just a little message that's like, "Bing, you have your settings set to this," and that's BS, Google. Figure out a way. Come on, that's stupid. Like, that makes me mad, because now there's this giant box in my homepage that is just text saying, "You can't open Gmail. Here's a link to open Gmail." It's like, they should be able to figure it out.
Yeah. So, you know, we talk about Google. Oh, everyone uses Google. Well, what the percentages are, Google is 74% currently. Mm-hmm. Yahoo is 17%. And Bing is at now 7%.
Nice.
So
effectively combine those last 2%. And essentially, that's what will be happening on the internet. And that's good. I mean, I like Google. We're both fans of Google. I use a lot of Google products, but competition is good for the market. True. If Google's on their toes, then they have to provide better products, which they do anyways. But the more heat they have underneath them, the more they'll have to hop around and try and give us good products.
It's definitely going to get interesting to see what comes out of this. You know, if Bing just blows them out of the water with some crazy new technology, because they are the part of the deal, and we'll get into that, is that they have to kind of share. Microsoft and Yahoo are sharing their what they already know. So Yahoo's mm-hmm. got to say, "Hey, this is some of the findings we already found out."
And Google does a ton of like that research. I mean, they're huge. They've been around forever. They have tons of research about what, you know, people want. And so I think that'll be really helpful. I think just being as much, Google is a good search engine. It's got a really good engine behind it. But the one thing Google hasn't really mastered is I think really capturing people's attention. I mean, you go and you search and you go to the next one. Even if you do an image search, okay, it's a big, you know, grid of images. Cool. But like Bing has things like if you search for videos, like if you hover over the video, it previews the video for you and stuff, which I mean, I'm not a huge fan of, but I think like the sort of younger MySpace, not 100% tech savvy group really likes things like that. You know, they're not bothered if sounds just start coming out of their computer. In fact, they like it, you know, whereas most of us don't. So Google kind of adheres to what the super tech savvy crowd is doing. And I think Microsoft, especially being, it has a lot of that crowd already with like Hotmail and Live and MSN
Messenger.
They're kind of
like, we don't care. We'll do anything it takes to get more people.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, okay, so maybe they're not, you know, Microsoft is usually pretty good about this. They focus on the entire consumer group, Google really focuses on tech heavy people.
And you know? Standards, a lot of standards too.
Yeah. So I think we're going to see Bing spike up. I think, you know, the more people that see you when they go to the search homepage, it's got this pretty picture, you know, they're going to say, "Oh, pretty picture." And they don't really care about super relevant results. So that's their search engine. And
just hearing, you know, articles and other podcasts, it seems like a lot of people really dig Bing. Yeah. I mean,
it's getting up there.
So part of the deal is it's 10 years. Microsoft will acquire, you know, an exclusive agreement with Yahoo for 10 years, and they have, you know, they have the ability to integrate Yahoo's existing search technologies in their web search.
Cool.
You know, Yahoo's going to be the one that does the premium search advertising still. Okay. And Microsoft's going to do the self-serve, kind of like the AdSense, through the Microsoft Ad Center platform.
Okay.
And let's see, I think it was 80. Yeah. Okay. So Microsoft will pay the traffic acquisition costs at to Yahoo at an initial rate of 88% of search revenue generated on Yahoo's O&O sites during the first 5 years of the agreement.
Cool.
And that's pretty much it. I mean.
So, I mean, what do you think? Do you think this is good for people? Is this bad for people? I got the feeling earlier that you were kind of maybe not on the fence, leaning a little bit more towards not a great idea.
Well, I was kind of nervous that, you know, Yahoo has, the, you know, the search technology right now. And if they give it all to, you know, Bing, and then, you know, what do they get out of it after 10 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're worried about what happens in 10 years. Does Microsoft just pull out and say, all right, we'll have fun? And then Yahoo's like, oh, well, we have, you know, 10-year-old antiquated search technology. Or,
well, how hard is it to sell ads versus create an awesome search engine? You know, Microsoft gets, at the end of the day, Microsoft gets to keep the search engine, and Yahoo gets its ads and the brand image, though, a little bit. Yeah. If people are going to the Yahoo front page versus Bing.com,
So the joke is, if you have like a wife or a really good buddy or something, you go to a party and you'll see this couple, you know, and then when they leave, you always say, you know, who's got the better deal of that? You know, like sometimes there's like this gorgeous woman and kind of this really, you know, unattractive guy, and you're like, wow, he got the better deal out of that because she is gorgeous, you know?
Yeah.
So when it comes to Yahoo Bing or Yahoo Microsoft, who came out on top on that?
I'm going to lean towards Microsoft.
Yeah, I have to agree with you completely, because they have a search technology that they're trying to get some market share on. It's much lower, and now all of a sudden you've got a big player like Yahoo that a lot of people have as their homepage and a lot of people go 17% to.
17% versus 7%.
Yeah, so I think Microsoft's on top. And at the same time, they're going to be able to help refine their search and hopefully get it better. I mean, like you're saying, if you're searching for Linux, I think at least Google tells me that, you know, Linux on Vista should not be the top results.
Yeah, you know, that just goes to show that, I don't know, I don't really trust it yet. Mm-hmm. I'm not switching anytime soon until I see that result change, because, yeah.
Yep.
If you're wondering what I'm talking about, just go to Bing.com and type in the word Linux and just look at the auto-populated results. And it'll say something like Linux Microsoft, Linux Vista, Linux, Windows XP.
You know, but those aren't based on relevant search results. Those are related to
Google does it, and they are.
Yeah, but this is, I mean, this could be that this is what people are searching for on Bing. You know, potato, potato. If people, the majority of people on Bing this isn't the results. This is the auto-population list while you're typing in a search. I think that's perfectly acceptable.
Well, if it is based off what people are actually typing, and most people, when they type the word Linux, the following word is Microsoft, then I would say, yeah, sure, it's acceptable.
Yeah.
But if they're just putting it up there to get better placement of their products.
Well, no, I don't think they are, though. I think you need to look at the people who are using Bing. Probably very heavy Microsoft users, very heavy Internet Explorer users, and if they're searching, they're probably Windows, and I think that that's legit, because I think it's probably based on what I would see the user base using Bing would be searching for when it comes to Linux. As long as the search results aren't tainted, and they're not, you know, it's like Linux Today, Ubuntu, Linux homepage, Linux.org, you know, Linux at Wikipedia. The audio population one, I don't know.
Okay,
I think that's Microsoft hate mongers getting angry about that.
I'm
in no way inferring that.
I am heavily biased. I you know, run a Linux website.
Yeah, so. But I think that's okay. Anyways, let's move on. So our next follow up we have is a while ago, and I can't remember what episode it was. It was quite a while ago. We talked about Google Graphs, the Google Graph API, which is this really easy way to make graphs by you basically, you know, in your HTML, you make the image tag, and in your source, you do all these query string stuff, and it gives you a really nice, pretty graph from Google.
Mm-hmm. They're usually basic graphs, bar charts, pie charts.
Yeah.
They even have a, you know, map, a simple map one, you know, where you can select certain states and things.
So what do we have here, Mark, that is better?
What we've got here is called ProtoViz. ProtoViz.
It is a graphical toolkit for visualization.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the same thing, except you're not using, you know, like a third party. You actually have the JavaScript. It's written in JavaScript, and you actually have the files on your own server, so mm-hmm. you're not making calls to Google. It looks like, I mean, it's basically the same. You just type in your data, and it makes the images on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
What I really thought this was, you know, neat is where, I mean, if you look at the examples, they have really sophisticated-looking charts where,
yeah.
you know, Google is very simple. It's bar charts, pie charts, like we talked about, you know, pretty straightforward. These are more, I mean, I'm sure you certainly can do those types of graphs, but it also has, you know, more advanced stuff like the Nightingale chart. I mean, if you saw them, you'd recognize them and say, oh, yeah, okay, I recognize exactly. that, but...
Yeah, there's they've got like a polar clock. They've got
here's one like hotel rooms, like you know the ones that are occupied are blacked out, and so you can space people out in certain rooms and make sure there's not, you know, 10 people in one area if you've got the rest of the hotel filled up and you got a bunch of noise in that one spot.
Yeah.
You know, just all kinds of stuff. So you, I mean, you could use that at like if you were developing a site that had seating arrangements or
mm-hmm. you know. And you download it and you have the actual files, so you don't have to worry about, I mean, sometimes you do have to worry about if Google changes the API, it might change your graphs, you might not even know it, you know. This is like, okay, they put out a new version, I have to go download it, which is a plus and a minus. You know, you do have to go out and download for new features and stuff, but at the same time, you don't have to worry about someone goofing with your API because you have them installed and you're including them on your site. And they've got some pretty, I mean, just pretty advanced graphs. It's like it's a Stanford project, so I'm assuming it, you know, it was
it's
like
BSD a, license, it was so a you can
grant
use it.
Funded project. So,
It was episode 10. We talked about the Google Graphs. If you want to check that out, I've actually used the Google Graphs API in one of my sites, and it's pretty nice.
Yeah, it's really easy to use. We use it where I work quite a bit too, because before you had to install like Image Magic and other little things that would go and literally create the image on the fly. And it's with this, it's just, you know, with these, you just make a nice little image tag. You don't have to do a whole bunch of hard leveraging, and it just pops up in your page for you. It's really easy.
And since it's not really an API, you could probably extend the JavaScript class, provide more colors, more functionality, maybe even have animations going on or something. Whereas the Google Graphs is a little bit more difficult to do, as it's more of a static call back and forth with Google.
And now I don't know, but one nice thing about the Google one is that it is really popular, really big. You can get Ruby libraries for it that, you know, plug in. You can get PHP plugins that do it, so you don't even have to do any of the real hard work. You can just pass in a hash that has all the information, and it'll do it for you. I'm not sure if this does. I haven't looked, but I would assume maybe not. Google is pretty popular.
Yeah, I would say they serve two different roles for the most part. I would say your simple, you know, simple graphs and pie charts and stuff, I would stick with Google. Mm-hmm. And for the more advanced stuff, I would check this out.
Yeah. So it is at viz.stanford.edu/protoviz. So all right, let's get into our web apps. Those are some good follow-ups. So we haven't had any good, like really good meaty news and follow-ups in a while. So it was kind of nice. But let's get into our web apps. So the first web app we want to talk about is the Google Wonder Wheel.
Okay, the Google Wonder Wheel, you can get to it by just, you know, going to Google and typing any search term. We'll do, like, web technology.
Jade Robbins.
Jade Robbins, okay.
No, you don't have to search Jade Robbins.
Oh, we can.
So you search, and then at the top, there's a little plus that says show options. And so you click that, and it kind of opens a little sidebar. And at the very bottom, under there's, like, standard view is selected. You can click Wonder Wheel.
And what this does is it basically just brings up like a, what do they call that? A spider chart or a...
I'm not sure. It's like a circle with sticks coming out.
It basically a mind mapping tool where, you know, you draw a circle and then you have
like a relational diagram kind of almost.
Oh yeah. So, So go ahead.
So here in the middle of the circle, you know, Jade Robbins, the search term that I searched for, and coming out of it are like five little spikes that have, you know, related search terms. So like Bozeman, Montana came up. Mark Sanborn is actually one of them. Jade Robbins share, Jade Robbins email. And so what you do is all these ones that come out, like let's say, Mark Sanborn, I click on your name and it kind of pops out and bubbles out. You have a lot more. Oh, yeah. Not you. Okay. I was like, wow, that's not cool. You have a lot more bubbles than me. So it pops out, you know, kind of a bubble with, you know, sticks around it showing that, you know, it's kind of related with more search terms, and it updates the search results on the side. It's kind of, you know, the regular mm-hmm. search results on the side. So, you know, I click on Mark Sanborn, some of the things, there's Mark Sanborn, Wikipedia, the Fred Factor, I'm assuming some of his books, Leaders in Business, not you, the other Mark Sanborn. That's unfortunate. And then on the side, like, you know, the first search result is Mark Sanborn speaking at eagletalent.com.
That's crazy that my name popped up when yours did.
Yeah, cool. we're bras.
So why would I use this, I guess?
Well, it's a good way to find sort of related search terms. So let's say I'm, you know, I want to see what's like related searches to Linux or something. You know, let's say you write a lot about web technology, you know. We found a couple, you know, sort of related terms that we could maybe try and focus our podcast more towards, our content, you know, and maybe even our titles for our posts or something, so that we can get more relevant search terms for someone who isn't looking exactly at web technology, but is kind of related in the peripheral of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a mind mapping tool to, you know, help you. Well, one way you could use it is you could, you know, find blog articles or, you know, topics for a show or, you know. If you're doing research and you might not have thought of that thing.
Yeah, one of the things I always say is I'm really terrible at searching. I never put in the right terms for what I'm looking for. So this would be a good way if I'm looking for something and I'm just getting no results, but I know it's out there. You know, there's things out there that you just know are out there, but you can't figure out how to find them. So I could go in here and I could search for that and be like, and, you know, do a little browsing through these relations and then go, oh, okay, well, that's what that's related to. So maybe I could go look in that area, or that's the search term I should be looking for.
So here's a good example. Like I just, you know, I'm Jade Robbins and it showed podcasts and then the Zen framework. We talked about that in one of the episodes. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You might not know that that was related to your, you know, Jade Robbins, except, you know, using something like that.
Yeah, we should do, they should make like a 6 degrees of separation game or something with this. So you'd be like Jade Robbins and then, you know, Panthers and see how many degrees of like search bubbles I am from Panthers.
Okay, well, I mean, it's pretty simple. You just type it in, show the options, click the Wonder Wheel, and you're off.
Yeah, it's cool. It's fun. It's cute. It's kind of just it's a good way to waste time, too, if you just want to, you know, toddle around. So let's move on to our next one, which is, oh, man, I don't know how to pronounce it. Pywik, maybe? Pywik, yeah, that has to be it. You get to it by going to pywik.org, P-I-W-I-K.org. And what is Pywik, Mark?
Pywik aims to be an open source alternative to Google Analytics.
No way.
So it's like your own self-hosted Google Analytic type clone that's open source.
But don't you know, Mark, that Google does everything better than everyone else?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, I would agree. Google Analytics is great. I mean, I use it. I love it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what happens? Maybe they change and you don't like something, or maybe you want to change hosts and, or I mean, not change hosts, but change like usernames. Like, you know, you're working with a company mm-hmm. and then you change. You don't have control of the data.
Yeah.
They've got exactly. it all.
And Pywik, I honestly have not seen many features that Google doesn't have in this. It's a very full-featured analytics program. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was very impressed when you first mentioned it. I thought, you know, because I've seen there's all kinds of sort of, you know, analytics web stats programs out there that have been for a long time. And the reason Google Analytics has been so popular is that it's not server-side. That was the big thing with other ones. They mm-hmm. would crawl through your Apache log, so you had to, like, do batch processing on them. They were ugly. It. They were hard to do. It was a pain in the butt. And Google Analytics was easy. It was just like, here's a JavaScript snippet. Throw in your website, and you can go take care of it. No problem. Well, this does the same thing, only it's hosted on your server. It doesn't go through Apache logs or anything. You go in and you add a new site that you, you know, you install it, which it just requires PHP and MySQL.
Yeah, it's the same way you know, for every site you want to track, you just put the JavaScript tag in there just like you would with Google Analytics, except it points to your own install of PyWik instead of Google Analytics.
Yeah. And it's great for, I think where this will really shine is for people who want the full sort of feature set of Google Analytics. But when you have clients and stuff, you don't really, you feel kind of dirty using Google Analytics. Either they set it up and then they send you and they have to share accounts to view it, which is okay. But at the same time, like I always, like a lot of people want a service that's hosted by you, not through Google. You know, so like I could start like Jade Robbins web stats for, you know, all my clients and then give them accounts and monitor their websites on here and put my logo up in the corner and stuff. It's open source and it's hosted locally and it's really full featured. I mean, it's great.
Yeah. If you're a designer or a developer, you could add to it if you didn't like something or if you wanted to extend it, maybe add some other analytics about your site that they didn't have. It's got an API that you can use and it's very full featured. I'm surprised because like you said, there's been analytics since, you know, the 90s or even maybe before that. And they just haven't been quite as good as Google Analytics. It's been, yeah. They're pretty good. There's some contenders out there, but
yeah,
this one is open source and you install it yourself. Bottom line.
Exactly. So, I mean, if you're a company with a lot of clients, install your own copy of PyWik and just include it in your design when you do it. Give them an account. Not everybody has a Google account. We assume everyone does. A lot of people do Google searches, but never even have to log in or need any of Google services. So you hate being like, okay, well, for stats for your website, you know, go create a Google account. And they're like, well, you know what they'll say is, well, I don't want to check another email. This is a way to disconnect that. You're saying, I'm offering this as a service to you as my client so you can get on. Your data is housed by me. You know, it's not Google's. A lot of people, I don't get as freaked out about it as most people. I think Google's a good company about that. But some people get freaked out by the fact that Google has all their information. Mm-hmm. And rightfully so, Google wants all that information so they can figure out how to sell you better ads. And some people see that as really evil. I don't personally, but I understand that people's concern for it. So this would be a good way to get something for your customers that, you know, is full featured. They're not going to be sacrificing any features, and it's hosted by you. It's that, you know, you have an explicit agreement with them, and it can alleviate some of their worries.
Yep.
It's funny. There's some things here I want to play with. I'm looking at their online demo right now. They even have like a feed burner statistics widget on the bottom.
Just implement
it. I wonder if it just integrates with it. I can't really try it. It's not working right now on their demo, but
Yeah, it's open source. You can add anything you want. If you wanted to have ads on your site and have ad tracking and have it all in one interface, you could do that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's great. It's even got goals and, you know, conversions and stuff. So it does all the same stuff that Google does. It's as far as I can tell. At least the features of Google Analytics that I use, it has them. And I think I might make my own install of it this weekend.
Try it actually. Out.
So that was PyWik. The next web app we want to talk about is called VizCheck. And this is, it's kind of a quick one. I think we'll go through it pretty quickly. It's not anything super special, but what it does, it's a website that lets you sort of look at things and check things out as if you were colorblind. Apparently, you know, there's a lot of people that are colorblind. It's very prevalent in men, especially.
I think men are the only ones that can get it.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. if that's my wife, the scientist, I'm sure she knows for a fact.
Pretty sure on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, so like you'd be surprised. So you can go to this and if you hit VizCheck on the side, you can check just an image or you can check a whole website. So you go in here and you put your web page like I did, jaderobbins.com, which is very orange heavy and there's some red in there. So I thought, oh, if you're red, green, colorblind, it might break. Luckily it doesn't break. It just looks really ugly yellow. You know, it looks like just a not good color of yellow, but it is functional. But if you go to this website and like especially if you click the, I think it's Daltonize link, they give you like good examples of a picture that, you know, of how a person who's red, green, colorblind would see it. And then, you know, a way that that you can fix it. It kind of alters the colors. The image doesn't look the same, but you can give it some sort of, I don't even know. They just kind of play with the colors so that a person who is red, green, colorblind can actually differentiate between items in the picture. Like in one picture, there's this sort of green grass and this sort of orange kind of winding road. Well, mm-hmm. a person that's red, green, colorblind, you can't see the difference between the hills and the road. So they have a way that you can alter the image. You can put an image in there and it'll do this special technique to it that kind of changes the colors enough that the person can then see the details of the pictures.
Does it change the image to the point where a normal seeing, you know, a non-colorblind person, do they see a goofy looking picture or they see...
It alters the colors. I mean, a little bit. You can notice like the reds aren't as vibrant, but it's still, you can still tell, you can still see the picture. It still is sort of a red color. It is a green color, but it just makes it so that it differentiates enough that a person that's red, green color might see it. This is something, I mean, we've talked about a little bit on the show once in a while, accessibility on your website. This is just, I think this is a good way. I would use the viz check to look at your website to make sure that there are things that are not, that make it unfunctional if a person is colorblind. If it looks bad, I think people who are colorblind are kind of used to the fact that what they're looking at might not be how everyone else sees it, but you need to make sure that you're not making it impossible for them to use your website.
So earlier you mentioned, males are more, you know, there's a lot of people that are colorblind, 7% actually.
Wow.
It's quite high. I mean, it's 7 out of 100 really people. And the, women can get it, but it's very low. It's 0.4%.
Oh, wow. That is pretty low. So, just go in. It's another thing. It'll take you 5 minutes. Check your website. Make sure, you know, that your theme doesn't have anything that would really prevent someone who is colorblind from, you know, fully using your website. Especially if you're a business, because... that's revenue lost.
Or like, yeah, if you had an image that displayed something definitely totally different from the original image, you want to make sure that's something like that's not happening.
Absolutely. So speaking of making sure things look useful in a way for people, our next web app, it's been around for a long time. It's BrowserShots, which is just browsershots.org. And what BrowserShots does is you give it a web address and it will actually go through with a ton of different browsers. They have a ton, and render your website and take a picture and then give it back to you. So this is really useful. If you've done any web development, you know the Internet Explorer just makes you want to pull your hair out. And especially if you're developing on Linux, you have to fire up a VM or go to another computer with Internet Explorer. Or if you're really hardcore, you can do it with Wine. But it's a pain, right? So you're like, mm-hmm. It looks good in Firefox. I'll just leave it.
Yeah. Or you just have Internet Explorer with Windows XP, but you don't test it with Vista or, you know,
yeah, IE exactly.
8 versus 7 versus 6. It's like you got to have all these things installed on virtual machines or something.
Yeah.
And it kind of becomes a kind of a pain. What this does, like you said, I mean, it's just literally dozens of different browsers and, you know, on Windows versus Mac versus they even have BSD.
Yeah.
Firefox 2.0 for BSD. Linux, they've got a huge array.
That's funny that BSD is still on Firefox 2.0.
You can install Firefox 3.5 on BSD for sure. Yeah,
but it won't come to fall because
probably not.
They want it to be ironclad. But yeah, so this is just a great way. It does. So if you don't sign up for a premium account, it can take you a couple minutes for them to give you results. But it's a good way to do, you know, sort of a one-time check to make sure that it, you know, looks good on various browsers. Like if you're, you know, on Mac right now, you can't really fire up Chrome and take a look at your website in it. Mm-hmm. And they even have some pretty obscure browsers that I haven't even heard of, you know, but...
some of these, though, like Flock or IceWeasel, you know, IceWeasel is basically what, just a Firefox... without the branding.
Exactly.
There might be some differences, though. I would doubt it, but...
well, this is good to look at. Like, we noticed that our floating left images on our homepage didn't work in some older browsers or some obscure ones. But it's just a good way. You need to check these, again, so you don't have to have all these operating systems installed and don't have to have all these different browsers installed. You can just go take a shot at it and you know, maybe look for big problems. There comes some point when you have to say, I am not going to support that, but I won't support Internet Explorer 6 in any project. I refuse.
Yeah.
So,
or like Safari 1 or 2.
Yeah, exactly. But even if, let's say, if someone said, hey, you know, I know a guy who's using Epiphany 2.22, what would my website look in it? You can go check it out. This has been around for a long time, but it's a good tool that I think we need to showcase for people to let them, you know, check it out. Browsershots.org. If you guys have any news, a follow-up, or web application you think we should talk about, let us know. Go to faceoffshow.com/feedback and give us a shout-out.
Yeah, I mean, if you're using a web app that we haven't talked about and you really like it, definitely let us know.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Because
we want to hear about it.
Yeah, because it's...
Even if it's something you think everybody else probably already knows about, you never know.
Yeah, exactly. The odds are I probably don't know about it. Sometimes you get those people who are like, hey, have you heard of this? It's been around forever. And I'm like, no. All right, so let's crank it to our topics and our topic this week, which is OAuth. So, you know, Mark, what is OAuth?
OAuth is a way, you know, okay, so web development, you know, we have a lot of APIs. We've got a lot of communication going on, you know, connect with this app, with this one. It came to a point where, you know, we were connecting so much that we don't want to just give out our passwords, usernames and passwords all the time. What OAuth does is it's kind of like a valet key for a car.
What is a valet key for a car?
It allows you to start the engine, unlock the door, but not the glove box, basically.
Okay. That's pretty handy.
But anyway, so it's like you can give limited amount of access, and also, you know, what OAuth is it's basically a token, so you can revoke access at any time. That the person or the app that you're connecting to doesn't actually know your username and password. Mm-hmm. You still have full control. Yeah. And you can set permissions.
Exactly. So it's a way for an API to like contact an application and talk to its API as you, but without giving the full credentials of your login and password.
Right.
Okay. So with OAuth, there are three sort of basic entities that you talk about. The service provider, which is the web application that allows access via OAuth. This would be like Twitter, this would be like Facebook, who have APIs, and they're providing that service to other applications.
Yeah, Twitter actually played a big role in developing this. Yeah. One of the lead developers of Twitter, Blaine Cook, was, you know, heavily involved in this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because Twitter, there's so many apps. Well, I mean, we've talked about a couple of them on the show, TweetDeck and CoTweet and all the different apps. You know, they needed a way to, you know, communicate without, you know, exchanging usernames and passwords.
Yeah. So the next sort of, you know, player in this game is the end user. You know, you and I, we go to Twitter, we go to Facebook, we play around, we do all these things, we change our login information to our password, our email. And then the last one is the consumer, which is a website or application that uses OAuth to access the service provider on behalf of the user. So I mean, what's wrong? What's wrong with just letting an API use my username and password? I mean, you know, what's bad about that, Mark?
The big setup. Well, I mean, if you give them your username and password, we have no idea how they're storing it. If somebody, you know, breaks into their site or whatever, they've got your username and password. Oftentimes people use the same password for multiple different sites. We would hope that they're hashing it, but we have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Another is if you change your password on Twitter and you don't tell the other app that you changed your password, it's going to try to log in. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be able to. With OAuth, you would have a token, and it doesn't matter if you change your password. It would still have access until you revoke that token.
Okay. So for the record of our listeners, so Mark and I, we do web apps for the show, which means we try a lot of stuff. And there's a lot of Twitter apps out there. I mean, it's almost ridiculous how many there are out there.
And we've signed up to many
of
them.
Oh, yeah. We've done so many of them, and we got to the point, I mean, we didn't even really think about it. They'd say, what's your Twitter username and password? We'd enter it in, log in, and say, okay, this is stupid. Not going to talk about it on the show. Close.
Right.
Never think about it again. Well, earlier this week, one of those applications was tweeting from your account without your permission.
Yeah, basically. I don't know which one it was or how it came about.
But there's no way you could.
Yeah, I'm assuming that that's what happened because they knew the username and password and they were able to get in.
It happened to a lot of people with the same message. So I'm assuming they'll find the sort of common connection eventually and shut it down. But so then what Mark did, like any sensible person, he said, well, man, they have the my username and password. I'm going to go change my password. Well, like he was talking about earlier, that same app was still trying to connect as you to do whatever with that username and password. And you got locked out of Twitter because you tried the wrong username and password too many times when you didn't try.
The app tried my username and password too many times. It's probably trying every 5 minutes or 2 minutes or whatever, trying to spam out.
Yeah. So like if this app used OAuth, that wouldn't be a problem. First of all, Mark could have gone into his Twitter account. So if you go to Twitter, into your settings, there's a connections tab. Mm-hmm. And there's all the apps that are using OAuth to get to your account. You can revoke access to particular applications one at a time. So you could have gone and revoked them all and added, you know, added them back slowly and then seen which one was actually doing something to your account.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think if you know, the app is connected with OAuth and they actually make a tweet out, it would say where it came from. This was from the web.
Yeah.
Meaning they use a username and password and probably a scraper or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then also one of the other benefits is that, we'll get into the way how OAuth specifically works, but one way, so what you have to do with OAuth is you have to go to the service provider and you have to like request request the ability to access other people's accounts. Mm-hmm. So what the other good nice thing about OAuth is they can disable an entire app at once and control it. So let's say all of a sudden you found out that this one app, even if it did connect through, if it connected through OAuth, this one app is causing a lot of trouble. With one swoop, they can cut off access for that. For every user for that, you know, and saying you're being a bad app, you can't have access. Which is great. So, you mm-hmm. know, if there was a spamming application out there, they can cut it off. It won't affect people. Each individual user won't have to kind of take care of it themselves.
So that would be, of the three, that would be the consumer. They're consuming the Twitter. Let's just use Twitter as an example. Mm-hmm. We're taking in the consumer and using the Twitter API. And then the end user is the one that's me and you.
Yeah, logging into the web. And yeah. So Twitter's really pushing OAuth for this reason. I mean, people's accounts are getting hijacked. There's been a couple really shady like get follower web apps out there where mm-hmm. you put in your username and password and they go like follow all the other people that sign up and stuff, and it's really greasy. OAuth is a good way to do this. So I mean, this sounds really complicated. APIs talking, the truth is it really isn't. I mean how does OAuth work?
It's basically you send, you know, a key back and forth, tokens and keys. You know, they're time stamped, so you can't replay. You can't take that same one and send it mm-hmm. again and get more access or whatever. Mm-hmm.
So I'm a developer. I'm writing a Twitter app, and I need to contact the Twitter API. And let's say they cut off access for username and password, I have to use OAuth.
Okay.
I would go to twitter.com and I would sign up for access to their API using OAuth, and I would fill in my information, and from that I would get a key.
Like a consumer key or carrier.
Yeah, they have a word for that. But I would get that key so that Twitter knows that's me. Twitter says, hey, this is this app. So then I go into my application and so from there, if someone comes to my site, I have sort of my little token. And, you know, I go to their website and they say, oh, I need you to connect to Twitter. So what that does is that user, you know, through a process that is completely transparent to them, my app takes my little identification key and goes to Twitter and says, hey, this is me and I want access to this user's account. And they say, okay, what user? Okay, Jade Robbins is logged in. So this key, which is, you know, is this application, needs to connect to Jade Robbins' account. And then that's when you get the big thing on Twitter that says this app wants access, allow or deny. Mm-hmm. And you would say allow. And then all built in with the OAuth spec, which actually was made a spec in December 2007, there is a URL that they return back to my application with then a key that allows me to do stuff to their account.
Like a token, yeah. And yeah. That token has limit, you know, you could limit the permissions that they have, you know. You wouldn't obviously want the app to be able to change your username and password. So that's, I guess, one advantage over with OAuth is they have limited abilities. Whereas if you give some app your username and password, they can just log in and do anything they want, including changing your username and password.
Exactly. It differentiates those users. So an API is a funny thing. So there are APIs that are coming and doing stuff on my behalf. And then there are some applications that use an API that the end user like me uses. You know, TweetDeck is a good example. That's the end user, me, using the API. But other applications, you know, they just kind of do their thing on the side, like, you know, the feed one that grabs an RSS feed and then tweets it out when there's something new. That's, you know, kind of doing it on my, it separates those users. So if I wanted to give an app like, let's say, TweetDeck full control, I want to follow users, I want to do all my account management in TweetDeck, I could use my username and password.
Mm-hmm.
But for an app that maybe I just don't want it, you know, if I'm just going to be, if it's going to be pulling information and not posting anything, I don't want it to be able to change my password, change my information, basic functions. You know, it would, you know, if they ask your username and password, you should think about it twice, you know, and tell and talk to that person and say, hey, you guys need to be using OAuth because it's a lot more secure.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of like built-in security stuff with OAuth too. There's like timestamp hashes and like, there's like a random thing so that someone can't just grab the same request twice in a row. You know, they can't just make the same request. There has to be like a random
Replay attack where if you were watching what one app was sending back to Twitter and you tried to send that exact same packet or sets of packets back to try to replay, it would say, sorry, this has already been used or whatever because it's timestamped and hashed.
Yeah. Now, implementing OAuth as a service provider is a little more difficult, it seems. So let's say
as being like Twitter, we should also mention, by the way, that the OAuth is not just for Twitter. It's an open spec that anyone can use for API.
Yeah, it's an open spec. Google's using it now. Yahoo's using it now. There's a lot of websites out there using it because it became a spec and the community was really happy with what they did. They felt it was really good.
Is this what Facebook uses to do the Facebook Connect?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't because Facebook just is a beast. But let's say as a consumer, you know, I'm a site making an application that wants to consume Twitter information or consume Google information. It is really easy to implement OAuth. There are PHP scripts. There's a Ruby gem to do it. I mean, you don't have to write any of the sort of meat behind it. I just get my consumer key from Twitter, and I go in and in Ruby in the Rails or the Ruby one that I was looking at. It, you know, I would say consumer equals, you know, OAuth. consumer.new and then put my consumer key in, and then, you know, as long as I have this information filled out right, the URLs will bounce back correctly. And once I get that sort of, you know, user key, then it's like connect.new and it's really easy.
Yeah, they've got the code that you need to get started in all kinds of languages: Java, Cold Fusion, C#, a lot of the frameworks, you
Python,
know,
yeah.
Rails and Django and .net.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's now the website to get information about it is oauth.net.
It's more of the spec, though. That's like the hard.
That's more of the spec, but it's a good way to find out. I mean, so let's say, like we talked about, it's really easy to find PHP apps or Ruby gems or, you know, what are they, Python eggs? That will do the sort of consumer side for you. But if you want to implement OAuth on your own API, I would suggest looking around these websites and figuring out how to do it. That's a little more complicated. Mm-hmm. But well worth it. I mean, you don't send username and passwords around in an email. You probably shouldn't be doing the same with all these applications, just throwing around everywhere. I mean, a lot of them claim, and you hope that they're, like you said, hashing it so that your password and username aren't in clear text in their database, but you never know. I mean, and if they get hacked, there you go. There's your stuff wide open.
Yeah, and it could be a simple problem as you get spammed because they get taken over, or it could be as simple as you get blocked out of your own Twitter because they're trying your username and password multiple times.
Exactly.
If you want to avoid all that, just be a little bit educated and watch and try if the app has OAuth to do that versus the username and password.
Yeah.
And if you're a developer, use OAuth.
Yeah, it's a new spec, so I think that there is a lot of resistance to change because people just would rather use username and password. It's faster, it's easier. But it's really blossoming, and I think it's really starting to become a really mature technology that people will keep using and it'll become a lot easier to use in the future. So I think it's something that if you're a developer, it would behoove you to learn it now and become really good at it, because it's something, especially if you're, you know, if you're just doing websites for companies, maybe not. But if you're trying to create like a software as a service or something that you're trying to make go big, you need to know OAuth, and you should probably use it for access to your API.
And if you're planning on making a Twitter app, definitely do it.
Yeah, Twitter is really pushing people to use OAuth happened to you. I mean, that's a big pain in the butt. It really annoys you, and it makes it look like Twitter apps are insecure, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't think there's a way that they can stop it now, but they're really trying to encourage, maybe by start educating users saying don't use apps unless they use OAuth, because these sort of bad, nasty things can happen to you. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I think I'm going to look at. I've been looking a lot lately as to how to develop our own API, especially since I started playing with Sinatra. It seems really easy. And so I think I'm going to try and play around and try and see if I can hook up OAuth on a Sinatra API and see how hard it is, because it's hard because you have to learn. First of all, you have to learn OAuth and how it works. And then you have to figure out it's not as automated as integrating it into your own application as a consumer, because you have to really manage your application to think about how you want to do it a little bit more. You can't just sort of throw in a plugin and all of a sudden you're like, hey, my API has OAuth, so you can use OAuth to authenticate it. It takes a little bit more programming, thinking ahead of time type stuff.
But fortunately, you know, Ruby and PHP and a lot of the popular languages, they already have at least the groundwork laid out for you.
Yeah, so I mean, at most, you're probably not going to be like muddling around with GET requests and stuff like that. It'll be pretty simple, mm-hmm. which is great. All right. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. And you can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Like we said last week, we just got a Google Voice number. So leave us a voicemail if you have a question or a suggestion. You might even hear yourself on the show and let us know. We'll see you guys next week.